Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris FX products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today, on Art of the Cut, we speak with Darren Navarro, ACE, who started his career with the legendary Roger Corman and has edited films including The Lovers, The End of the Tour, Killer Joe, and I Love Dick. Darren has worked with legendary director William Friedkin for years, starting as an assistant editor. Navarro talks about the Kane Mutiny Court-Martial, his final collaboration with Friedkin, who passed away recently. Before I hop into our discussion with Darren, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for Mac OS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative visions of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optix, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Darren Navarro, ACE, discusses editing the Kane Mutiny Court-Martial. Thanks so much for joining me, Darren. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's exciting to talk about this one.
First of all, did you watch the original movie?
I had never seen either previous movie iteration of this material when about a year ago I found out we were going to do one. Having worked with Mr. Friedkin for many years, I knew that he loved the original Edward Dimitrick, The Kane Mutiny, 1954. In particular, he loved Humphrey Bogart and Humphrey Bogart's performance in that movie. He never really talked much about the play, The Kane Mutiny Court-Martial, which is a separate piece of source material, but, you know, written by the same guy. So I went back and I watched The Kane Mutiny and enjoyed that. And I watched Robert Altman's version of The Kane Mutiny Court-Martial, which he did in 1988 with a terrific cast. And I was curious at that point what Billy wanted to bring to it that hadn't been done before. And that was to be revealed. You know, I eventually found out. It is a different take for sure in a number of respects. He's updated it to modern times when both of the earlier iterations were faithful to the World War II setting. And he definitely went for a leaner, sparer telling of the story than even Altman did. So yeah, I did my homework just in time to start this one. But in a way, I almost wish I hadn't seen the movie, because the cool difference between the novel slash movie, you know, of the Kane Mutiny and the play and the movies that have been made from the play is that the play doesn't show you what happened. You, as an audience member, has to put together in your own mind a picture of what happened on the ship based on the testimony that you're getting from all of these various people. And you have to make up your own mind, which is, for me, a more interesting experience as an audience member, and certainly more in keeping with the kind of movie that Billy wanted to make and was always interested in making. He always wanted to make movies that were fraught with ambiguity and that invited the audience to sort of grapple with the question of right and wrong throughout and never give them an easy way to either judgment.
You kind of alluded to the fact that you aren't sure whether you were happy that you watched the original. And that's one of those things I've talked to many editors about, And it's split about 50-50 of people going, of course I had to do my research. Of course I needed to know what had gone on before me. And other people are like, no, I don't want that in my head.
It's interesting. I just had a little viewing party at my home last night with a group of friends and editors. There were no special screenings here in LA. So I said, well, come to my house. We'll watch it over here. I saw it at the Venice Film Festival, you know, about a month ago. And then prior to that, it had probably been several months before I had seen a cut. And so now I'm a year away from having watched the Caine Mutiny. And I've been through this process, even in my own involvement in the material. I feel like last night when I watched it with friends, it was the first time where I really was able to just throw away my experience of having seen the Caine Mutiny and having, quote unquote, witnessed what happened on the ship and really just regard this material for what it is, which is that you're not meant to know. And it played differently for me last night. And that's always a hugely pleasurable experience for me as an editor, and always catches me off guard, even though it happens constantly, which is that I've gone through the whole process of editing the film. I've gotten in so deep with the director and sometimes with the writer, if that's a different person, and the producers. And I feel like I know the material inside out. I feel like I know the movie and all of its themes and all of its, certainly know its details. I can quote it verbatim. I don't even mean to quote it. And it's just becomes part of my inner monologue, you know. And then months later, I'll see the movie again. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing it in a different way. And I'm seeing things in it that I never saw before, even though I was involved with it. And it may be just because my emphasis was different creatively as I was working on it. And there were themes that were embedded in the material that I wasn't even really rocking. Sometimes we're using one lens or set of lenses when we're doing the work. And then when we have an opportunity to walk away from it and come back, we're granted a whole different set of lenses through which to see something that we ourselves were involved with. And it's like, oh, here's how another person might be experiencing it. That's always a really sort of positive development for me. And I had it last night.
Could it be the specific audience that, absolutely, you know, Venice is... Yeah, I mean, yesterday was an invited group of editors, right?
Yeah, it was an invited group of editors. It was all people I know, editors and others, friends of mine. Venice was a weird experience for me because, I mean, I loved being there. I loved being there for Billy's last film. I mean, I wanted Billy to be there, obviously. I knew ahead of time that it was probably the last one we were going to do together, probably the last film that he was going to make. That seemed the most likely reality. And as soon as we knew that it was going to be at the Venice Film Festival, I bought my tickets. I went, you know, so I wanted to be there. It was going to be, we were going to premiere his, what was almost certainly going to be his last film. And then he didn't make it. It was a real bummer. I would say that screening, I probably wasn't even paying as much attention to the movie as I might have in another situation. It was a celebration for him. Damien Chazelle went up and introduced the film for the Venice audience in a really, really lovely tribute. They had developed a relationship over the last several years. Annabelle Dunn, who was one of our producers, went up and introduced the film, but in a way that had as much to do with Billy and his legacy as it did about the film itself. So that's really where my head was at. And it was kind of emotional. And I don't know that I really experienced the movie in that setting. And last night, I really just got to relax and enjoy the movie. And again, as I say, because it had been now a year since I'd watched The Caine Mutiny, I really feel like I was able to watch this film without too much background noise, as it were.
Tell us a little bit about your relationship and how you went from the beginning of your relationship with him to editing his last film.
My first experience on any movie of his was the end of 1994 on Blue Chips. If you were anywhere in the editorial community in 1994, you heard about Blue Chips because it was a real headache for Paramount. It was the movie where Billy had had enough of editing on film. He really, really wanted to move into editing on the new digital systems that were becoming available. Unfortunately, the way he got there was a bit of a bloodbath. He wound up firing an entire editing crew, and Paul Hager, who was the head of post-production at Paramount at the time, had to deal with the fallout and finding new editors. Fortunately, I came in very close to the end of all of that. I was aware of the nightmare that had preceded me, but by the time I got there, David Rosenblum was the last of probably at least five editors who had been on the picture, and I was just helping out. I was a second assistant, essentially, even though, to my memory, Hager was paying me as an apprentice, but that's another conversation. You know, I did like 6 weeks on the project or something. I never crossed paths with Billy on that. But about a year later, one of the editors who Billy had been introduced to on the Blue Chips experience was this guy, Augie Hess. And Billy really liked working with Augie. Augie just had an encyclopedic understanding of what the material was. He just managed to just get it all in his head and keep track of everything. He was a very good organizer and also a very good editor. So Billy decided from that point forward that he wanted to continue working with Augie. They did a Showtime thing in the interim, a little thing called Jailbreakers. And then when they started Jade about a year later, which was a big Robert Evans produced, Joe Esterhaas written thriller for Paramount, Augie went looking for assistance and my name was put into the hat. And when he found out that I had even set foot in an editing room that was, you know, one of Billy's projects, he said, okay, you've got the job. You've probably come into contact with what's necessary to make this work. I took the job fully expecting that we were all going to be fired within 4 months and I would walk away with great stories. But Billy wound up being just very happy with the way the editing room ran. And so that team, pretty much Augie and me, with, you know, another team of sort of assistants who sort of came through, wound up doing like his next four pictures. So I developed a relationship with Billy. He really liked working with us as a team. And those were all at Paramount, with the exception of a 12 Angry Men remake that we did for Showtime. And then when the Paramount regime changed in the early '00s, Friedkin was, you know, kind of no longer there. His wife had been the head of the studio for that whole period of time. So I think when the regime changed, it was a natural move for him to leave the studio as well. His first picture after that was this relatively smaller budget theater adaptation, another theater adaptation, which he hadn't done in many years. He went to Augie with it, and Augie was busy. He had a job on a TV show as both a producer and an editor. And Augie is an extraordinary editor, but I don't think he was ever naturally inclined toward weird material. And Bug is very definitely weird material. I was very drawn to weird material, and Friedkin knew that from our interactions. I had, by that time, edited one independent film on my own. I'd done my first feature. Friedkin never asked to see it or anything like that. He just knew from our relationship that I could probably handle the job. So when Augie turned down Bug, Billy came to me and said, are you ready to take that chair? And I said, absolutely. I'd gotten a tip that he was considering it. It was a couple months between that tip and when he finally called. And I had sort of already rehearsed in my head what I was going to say when he offered it to me, and which was to say very little other than just yes.
Yes would be the thing to say.
Yes and thank you. But I was upstairs at Amoeba Records in Hollywood in the movie section, and I got the call from the unlisted number. Almost nobody had an unlisted number at that point. So when I got a call from one, it was probably from Billy's office. And so I took it, obviously, and it was about a 2-minute call. And I said, yes and thank you, and let's get started. That was it. In 2005, and that's when we did Bug. When Billy called Augie to say, I'm thinking of having Darren do it, after Augie had turned it down, and he said, I'm thinking of having Darren do it, what do you think? Augie said, absolutely, go ahead and do it. Augie was a great sort of like passive teacher. He was really good at vocalizing everything that he was doing and the decisions that he was making as an editor, both in terms of editing room management, but also creatively. We talked a lot creatively about the movies that we were working on. It was never a situation where he was like saying, sit down and let me mentor you, young man. You know, he never really saw himself as a teacher, but because he was so open about how he did things, it was easy to learn a lot from him. Interestingly, I just had lunch with him yesterday, and I did have an opportunity to tell him that. When he and I worked on the first season of CSI, he gave me scenes to cut, and he seemed to be happy enough with what I was doing and gave me a few notes. And, you know, that was a more typical editor assistant mentor relationship. I think when we were working with Billy, he really felt a stronger need to really control every part of the process. And so that opportunity didn't come to me in that context, but I think he had just seen enough to know that he could give his endorsement to Billy's idea to bring me on. Friedkin and I, our relationship was that we would talk about movies. You know, we would talk about the movie we were working on, but he would, you know, he could turn to me and say, you haven't seen Two for the Road, you have to see Two for the Road. And then I would write that down and I would go watch Two for the Road, and I would come back and talk to him about it. You know, my best relationships with any of my collaborators, particularly directors, is our shared love of movies and specific movies. And that was definitely at the heart of how Billy and I got along. It was a little different, the value that he placed in Augie.
It struck me as you were describing Augie bringing you on for that first picture with him that none of it really had anything to do with your skill set. It was, you survived this show. He likes you. You talked to William about movies. Like you said, he probably didn't watch the first independent movie that you edited.
He tended not to hire people based on having seen their work. He based his hiring decisions based on conversations with those people and realizing that he had common ground with them. I don't know that he had ever seen anything Augie had done. He famously said that when he hired Owen Roizman to shoot The French Connection, he had never seen a frame of any movie that Owen Roizman had shot. It was his conversation with Owen about, you know, how he likes to shoot, and that he said, okay, this is the guy for the project. So it's atypical for sure to do it that way, but it served him well throughout his career. You know, with editing, I think of like about 80% of my job is conversational. It's so much of what goes into the film has to do with my conversations with the directors and with others. But I'm really just trying to absorb, what is the director's vision for what we're doing here? What are they after? And how does it compare to other things that we've seen, the things that we love? All of those things feed into the actual sitting at the Avid and making cuts in the film. Ultimately is, you know, really only about 20 to 30% of the intellectual work that goes into making the movie. I think so much of it just has to do with getting to a common mindset with your collaborators.
I want to use that as a transition to get into talking about this actual film. But first, I wanted to ask you two things about Blue Chips and Jade, which was, both of those were cut on Avid or no?
Blue Chips started out as a film show. And one of the reasons it became such a headache is these basketball scenes were shot basically like live TV. I think he had 10 or 11 cameras actually on the basketball footage. And if my memory serves, he literally had five Nagras going. So he had audio being recorded. Like, he had the commentators, he had the players mic'd, he had the coaches, right? So there were just an insane number of cameras and mics in every one of these. He was basically just staging these basketball games. Cameras were expected to exhaust their roles and reload during the games. So it became very documentary-like. As a film show, which was being cut on Chems, the dailies, it was this huge library of film that they had to get through to make this cut. Billy was famously disinterested in watching editor's cuts. It was not a part of the process that he could handle. And this became maximized exponentially in the Blue Chips setting. He didn't want to look at an editor's cut. So Bob Lambert's initial cut had to be, you know, they made a dirty dupe, and then they at all had to be reconstituted back into film rolls. At that point, it became a Lightworks show, and everything got digitized into Lightworks over a period of weeks. New editors were brought on, and there are a lot of details to the story. But anyway, and that's how Augie wound up on the project, because he had gone from editing into consulting for Lightworks, and so was considered one of the most knowledgeable editors in Lightworks, and that was really his route back. Jade was also done on Lightworks. I was primarily the film guy at the beginning. There was another guy who was sort of, quote unquote, the Lightworks assistant, and I was running the film room as the assistant. And then by the time we did 12 Angry Men, which would have been the next project, we moved over to Avid. And that was really my first Avid show. Lightworks was kind of running out of steam at that point as a kind of going concern.
We won't tell Thelma.
Oh, I love that Thelma. I loved Lightworks. I still get nostalgic about that controller.
Let's talk about this film. It's based on the play. It's in very few locations. There's like a hallway that's outside the courtroom, and then in the courtroom, and then, you know, finally a party location. Tell me about trying to keep that interesting, trying to keep it visually dynamic, and what the challenges were there.
Beyond the things that you pointed out, also everybody's wearing the same costume because they're all dressed the same. Everybody's military. They're all in uniform, and it's a very naturalistic, realistic kind of courtroom. There's nothing interpretive about it. For instance, when in Altman's version, he stages it in a basketball gymnasium that has clearly been sort of repurposed as a courtroom, as though it's just kind of like a makeshift courtroom, which gave it a kind of visual angle that Friedkin didn't go for. He just really presented it as you would expect. So the only thing that can keep that compelling is great actors. And he found a dozen great actors to come in. I went to the planned table read before we shot. Turned out not to be a table read. It was mostly just a session for the actors to sort of give questions to Billy about what they should be doing, to talk about the text, make any final changes that they wanted to make before they went forward. He said in that meeting, "The thing that I want more than anything out of any of you is spontaneity. I don't want it to feel canned. And it is absolutely critical that everybody show up knowing their lines."
The length of some of those scenes, you're like, oh my gosh, the memorization alone would be crazy.
Kiefer Sutherland did his, because he testifies twice in the trial. And anyway, so the second time is for the defense. And he's on the stand for 22 minutes. Kiefer did that in two perfect 22-minute takes.
What?
One was slightly more manic than the other. So he kind of had two slightly variant energy tones. And I was able to use parts of both for depending on which part of the testimony he was in. You know, he gets a bit more amped up as it goes along. So I was able to use his first take for the kind of roughly the first half of that scene, and then kind of emphasized the second more manic one for the second half.
Shot with how many cameras?
Generally, there were two cameras on everything. I think there were a few parts of the film where they went to three. Every scene, as defined by generally by a witness taking the stand, a particular witness. There are a few other little scenes in there that are not about witnesses, but generally it's one or two setups emphasizing the witness, one or two setups emphasizing the counsel and the judge panel, and that's it. And Billy wanted to do everything in one take. So if there was a mistake or an actor really, really wanted to have another go at it, he'd go for a take two or a take three. But it was a minimum of takes, which meant that I didn't have a huge amount of footage to go through, barring the length of some of the takes. They were long takes, but there weren't many of them. But it also meant that when maybe the blocking wasn't perfect, or there was a mistake or a flub or something like that, there always wasn't a lot to go to. You know, I really had to make the most of minimal options. But the thing that keeps it exciting is the actors. Every actor came in off book and they just killed it. There's not a weak link in the cast. Every witness is just phenomenal.
And I loved some of the storytelling that the editing did with moments that were either held on an actor like Kiefer after he spoke, mm-hmm. kind of revealing after he spoke what he was thinking, or the reverse, that you would cut to him a moment before. Or I was thinking about the intercutting the first time the judge is asking Queeg questions, just choosing you want to be on the person speaking, you want to be on the person thinking.
In general, just in anything that I do, I am always at least as interested, if not more, in someone hearing the dialogue than in the person saying the dialogue. Putting the emphasis on the listener allows you to really pick and choose which lines of dialogue you want to hit, so that when you do go to the person who's speaking, you're putting an emphasis on whatever they're saying in that moment, rather than giving equal weight to everything that they say. And it also gives you the much more interesting experience, for me anyway, which is watching an actor's face who's listening and thinking. As you say, you get much more interiority through an actor's expression, through their little gestures of their hands or their eyebrows or whatever it is, than you necessarily get from the things that they're saying. And that's, I'm always looking for ways to put the emphasis there. And then when you do make that cut away to the person who's speaking, you make sure that it's something that will have a greater resonance because you withheld it for a while.
Your story about Kiefer doing two 22-minute takes makes me think, you know, for many of us as editors, you're like, yeah, I had to cut there because there was a mistake. Sure. Or the actor went a little south in the performance or something. But truly, it sounds like you were able to say, I'm going to be on the close-up at this moment. I'm cutting to this shot for that specific reason, not to cover some technical issue.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's always a mixture of both, and this film was no exception. You certainly try to make as many decisions as you can based on the pure creative needs of the scene and of the moment, and then you encounter a technical issue of some kind, and you have to do your best to build a work around that feels as intentional as the work that you're doing everywhere else in the film, right? Billy used to call it just hanging a lantern on it. When there's a mistake that you can't hide, then you lean into it and like highlight it so that it feels intentional. It feels like, oh, they meant to do that. Because there were so few takes and because there wasn't a lot of advance rehearsal, he didn't meticulously choreograph the scenes. He was really just letting the council characters, Chally, who's played by Monica Raymond, and Greenwald, who's played by Jason Clarke, letting them just kind of roam freely. Very often the blocking was tricky because they would forget when the cameras would turn around exactly what their path had been back and forth. And so off, you know, the witness would be looking in exactly the wrong direction. We're not even talking about a 180 issue here, right? The 180 issue, it does not apply in this
movie. It's more like eye lines.
It's much more about eye lines. Literally, the witness is looking to the left side of the courtroom, and the prosecutor in that moment is standing on the right side of the courtroom in the reverse shot. And I would have one or two takes of this. So sometimes, truly, when I'm staying with a character, it's because I'm waiting for the blocking to realign. But also, using that kind of cutting tempo throughout the film makes it more acceptable in those moments where I'm also doing it for a technical reason. Like, for instance, on the Urban character, who's played by Gabe Kessler, great performance. He did one take. It was out of this world, right? Just a terrific one take performance. The blocking didn't match at all on the prosecutor. I actually went to Billy because he was like pressing me every day. You know, I don't want this thing overcut, Darren, but it's got to move. It's really got to move. And I'm like, okay, I hear you, Billy, on both points. He goes, and let us know if we're not getting everything. So of course, the trick with Billy is he'd say, let us know if we're not getting everything. Let us know if we need to pick something up. And then I'd come to him. Why do we need that? He would tell you to come to him. And then when you came to him, he would mount such resistance to the idea that he needed to pick something up. And so I did a cut the best I could with the footage that I had. There were some points where the blocking just didn't match. I showed him the scene. He goes, this is a great performance. Why would I want to reshoot this? And I said, well, it is a great performance, but he's a great actor and he'll give us another great performance if we just get him back in the chair and we know which direction he should be looking at and we do a take like that. He heard me. We got the actor back, put him in costume. He sat around for 2 days in costume waiting for his reshoot. The producers and I would be reminding Billy, like, you know, Gabe's here. We're ready to do his. He goes, can I see his take again? And we would put it up in Video Village and he would walk in. This is great. I go, I know. But at the end of the day, he didn't reshoot it.
What?
Send him home.
Wow.
Send him home. And I was like, okay, just make the best with what I've got. And there is a point. I had to find a way to disguise it. But if you're really paying attention in that scene, there's a point where, I mean, I use the judge as a round robin to get away from it for just long enough. And we put in a few little like Foley steps to make it seem like the prosecutor had walked to the other side of the room. But really, like, she's over here a few seconds later without actually the camera having moved with her to the other side of the room. She just pops up on the other side of the room and it's just like, that's it. We just got to go with it. But it was a combination of staying away from her for just long enough that it was plausible that she had crossed the room and you're just so caught up in everything else that's going on that you don't notice. But that's the kind of stuff that you have to, you know, you press for that pickup or that reshoot, and then you don't get it. And then you just have to make it work with what you have and pray that no one notices.
So you've got a long stretches of a scene, but luckily it sounds like you didn't have a lot of takes. So maybe organizing that wasn't too bad.
The kind of process that we go through in terms of organizing was much less of a deal on this one. I think all in there were maybe 20 scene numbers. No, it's had to be more than that. Maybe like 30 scene numbers or something. And again, minimal takes, minimal setups. It's a very austere shooting plan, which was by design. And as you mentioned, there's the party scene at the end. We have two scenes back to back in the early going of the movie where there's clearly a recess that's been taken and there's a conversation both in the courtroom and then it moves out to the hallway. And then immediately after the trial, there's a short scene in the hallway. There were a few other little hallway scenes that we took out, other little breaks that happened that we just decided were unnecessary. And that really did keep the emphasis on the witnesses and just keeping that pace up of just, you'll notice with rare exception, we didn't let any witness get out of their chair and leave the room. We would lead them in a little bit, let them be introduced by whichever counsel was calling them to the stand. But almost all of them we cut while they're still in the chair and then immediately introduce the next witness and have them basically already standing about 3 feet from the chair. That was all very intentional. In fact, he staged it that way. Really, most of those witnesses just walked to the chair from about 3 steps back. He didn't even put them in the hallway to begin with. Only Queeg walks in from outside, and really only Queeg leaves, like literally leaves the chair and walks back all the way outside. Only he's given that sort of entrance and exit. Merrick, who's in the room the whole time, sort of has an entrance and exit to his own chair. Everybody else, it's just like, get in at the last possible second, get out before the last possible second, and already be introducing the next witness. Billy wanted no shoe leather. Entrances and exits were not interesting to him. That was his intention, was to just keep it moving, never let the audience's interest in the proceedings flag.
I'm trying to think of score in the movie. Can you talk about...
There isn't any. We have a single drum march at the beginning of the movie. It used to be two, but then we simplified the main title. So we ended up with one little, very, very short burst of a drum march just to say, this is a military setting at the beginning. And we have a needle drop at the end. It's Bozgag's lowdown, which is sort of the music that's playing in the party sequence. When Greenwald goes in, the music is sort of turned off as he starts to make a speech. And then it comes back as the end credit theme. Billy loved an unexpected needle drop at the end of a movie. And it just makes it fun. It ends the movie on a very sort of upbeat note and makes you question whether or not everything that you've seen is perhaps just a lark. Billy basically always said he didn't want any score in the film. He knew from the get-go. The question did come up from producers and executives, not in any kind of pressured way. It was sort of like, do you think there's room for music? And I kept thinking about it and I was like, I don't know what it would do other than kind of just distract. The movie is so minimal and, again, so austere. I can't imagine the music that would feel like it belonged in the movie. And usually I can.
Was there any difference in the way the film started? It always starts in the hallway with the discussion of the guys coming in.
That is the first scene of the play. I think there's a little bit of a preamble in the text about Article 1108. Which we dispensed with because that comes up in the trial and is the law that Merrick cites in justifying his mutiny or his alleged mutiny. But we got rid of that at the beginning. But the first scene of the play is Greenwald and Merrick walking in and Greenwald basically telling him that he would rather be prosecuting him than defending him and just really laying down the terms of the tension between them throughout the whole thing, which is that Greenwald isn't even sure he's doing the right thing by having taken this case. The exterior of the building was shot in San Francisco on Treasure Island. That is a naval headquarters. I don't think it's actually a courtroom. It is at least historically, an actual naval building. So they dispatched the AD up to San Francisco to make that one shot that opens the movie. And then after that, we're basically indoors the rest of the time.
You mentioned that Friedkin doesn't like looking at an editor's cut.
Yeah.
And there are definitely directors that feel the same way. Like, what is the point of torturing myself with this?
Sure. Yeah.
Right. But tell us what the process is if there's no viewing of the editor's cut.
There are a number of directors that I worked with multiple times, right? And so as you work multiple times with a director, you get to know their comfort level with certain things and how they like to work and what their expectations are. For Friedkin, who was a director who obviously has, for most of his career, wielded a certain amount of power, he basically, what he wants, he gets. If he doesn't want to look at an editor's cut, he's not going to look at an editor's cut. And there's nobody's going to talk him, you know, into it or out of it. So that was how he always worked. He wanted to come in. He expected us to do a cut because he knew that that was how we would get to know the footage and how we would get to know any potential problems in the footage. It's how we would get to know that, for instance, we needed pickups, even if he was going to push back when you asked for them. He expected you to go through that process. And then he would come in a few days after shooting and really just put up the footage, start with scene one, and we would put that together. And then we would move on to scene two. And honestly, he was very decisive. He was very quick when we did Killer Joe in that way. I think we had his first cut of the movie, he and I sitting shoulder to shoulder in 2.5 weeks, something like that, just blazed through it and had a really, really credible first cut. I mean, the reality is Billy was himself a great editor, you know, in his mind. He didn't know how to use an Avid, but he always said he could never proceed with making any movie until he had already seen the movie in his head. And when you have spent hours, years with the guy, and you realize the clarity with which he remembers like the most insignificant events from 30 or 40 years ago, you really understand that he has this incredible visual memory. And so once he has conceived the movie in his head, he knows exactly how he wants it cut. He would come in very with clear notes in his notebook and say, okay, now we're going to go to the two, and now we're going to go to the wide, and now we're going to go to the insert. He knew exactly how he wanted to cut it. He would count on my familiarity with the material to solve problems, because his clarity of vision did not preclude errors. You know, it didn't mean that
the blocking issues, right?
Yeah, they didn't mean there weren't going to be mistakes that or problems to solve. So he needed me there to help solve the problems, but he definitely came in knowing how he wanted it cut. And with other directors, I've developed other, you know, at least one other director I work with is like, do the best cut possible. I don't even need to see the whole script. Just keep working on it. Like, he wouldn't even come in for 2 weeks until after shooting, letting me do what I thought was the best version of the movie, even if it meant deleting scenes or writing ADR and doing all this kind of stuff. Like he said, show me the best possible version, you know, the polar opposite, right? In between, there's a range of expectations and levels of comfortability with the work that I present them with initially, right? So to address the elephant in the room, Billy was not in great health when we made this movie, and it was hard for him to get around. So he came to the cutting room for the first 2 days on this project. We worked in the usual way, but we were working very slowly. We hit that urban scene on day three, you know, the scene where we had the dodgy blocking, and he knew that I had asked for a reshoot. I said, this is the scene that I asked you to do the reshoot on, and I've done the best I can with the footage that we have. I'd rather just show you my cut so that you don't have to deal with the blocking issues. And he says, okay, show me what you got. So we looked at that scene and he says, that was great. What else you got? And then we looked at the next scene. And then we looked at the next scene. And for the first time in my history with him, and as far as I know, going back decades, he looked at an editor's cut. We watched the whole rest of the film. And he gave me, we're too long on her. Pull that back a little bit. In maybe that note a couple of places. He had me cut the end of the movie short, that final moment. You know, I had initially just sort of left that take through its natural end and let Greenwald leave frame. And we said, no, we're going to cut that shorter. And then he left. And he said, I don't know what I would have done differently. You know, he left me with like half a dozen little notes, which was not the expected outcome of that. None of what had happened in that previous, you know, 2 hours had been expected. Then he called the producer, Annabelle, the next day. And he said, so when are you going to come see the movie? And she says, well, I want to give you your time with it. He says, we're done.
3 day director cut.
3 day director cut. I mean, really 3 half days. Like, it was nuts. And she goes, are you guys really done? I go, well, he seemed to like my cut. Wow. So she and Matt Parker, the other producer, came in. They looked at it. Over the course of the next week or two, we brought the studio in and they were like, thank you. Thank you for showing us the film. And they had no notes. Sherry Lansing, who's Billy's wife, looked at it. She had one note, which was a very good note, which is that she felt like she wanted to see more of Merrick in the first half of the movie. Billy didn't really spend a lot of time covering Merrick during all of the various witnesses' testimony. He basically did one long take on him during, I'm pretty sure it was during Queeg's initial testimony, and then never really bothered to sort of put the camera on him specifically during all of the other witnesses. So I just had to mine that one shot of Merrick for all of the reactions that we use throughout the movie. She needed a little more of that. She goes, this is the guy whose life is on the line. We should probably see him a few more times in the first half. And I was like, you're absolutely right. And I went and I found those shots. And that was it. I mean, I think the version that we locked, which by the way was V4, was about somewhere between 8 and 10 minor changes away from my editor's cut. And that was unexpected, definitely a twist ending on my 30-year career with Mr. Friedkin. And it was very gratifying. And at the same time, I was like, I was supposed to have a job this year. But the producers were very cool and they kept me on. We couldn't really move the mix dates or the color correction dates. Those were kind of locked in based on the schedules of the facilities. And
10 weeks later.
Yeah, a week later. And so like I kept myself available. I was available to come in and consult on main titles. And, you know, we obviously had a few little digital things that we had to push through, mics and things like that needed to be cleaned up. But it was a very minimal sort of supervisorial role. And they were very, very kind to sort of keep me on for the whole process, knowing even in February that a writer's strike was probably imminent. I was deeply appreciative of their generosity in that way.
Absolutely.
We really locked it. I mean, like locked with everybody's input within like 2 weeks.
Thank you so much for chatting with us about your involvement and about Mr. Friedkin too.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Bye.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Darren Navarro, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, Boris FX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.